Hello, I'm Arnold Hamilton, editor of the Oklahoma Observer.
And I'm Marianne Martin, and this is ObserverCast, your weekly deep dive into Oklahoma politics and policy,
presented by the Mary Lou Lemon Foundation.
We're so glad to be here today with someone that I'm low-key fangirling over, trying to like keep my cool here. But we'll just start with, like, seriously, no, she's a big deal. I'm so glad she's here with us. So go ahead and tell us who you are and tell us about what you do.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me. So Erica Lucas, I run an organization focused on building a more equitable economy through not just entrepreneurship, but inclusive economic development. And I love everything that you guys are doing. We need more of it, proven by this election. So appreciate everything that you guys are doing.
And I should say, this is our first episode, actually kind of in a while, but post-election, right? I think, Arnold and I texted the morning after, and we certainly had some thoughts, but it was, Yeah, there's a lot to digest, and it's going to unfold. And but really, can you tell us, there's a specific reason why, we thought you were a really good person to talk to for the issue that we're talking about today, which was this this event that the Oklahoma Commission on the Status of Women put together. But we'll get to that in a minute. I really wanted to kind of dive into the work that you do. The public work that you've been doing the past, for a while. This is not new, but just regarding kind of like, public discourse and public events and current events. So can you talk about that a little bit for us?
Yeah, I apologize. I'm still like foggy from last week. So I'm like, okay, stay on topic.
Yeah,
right.
Or don't.
Elaborate on the work that I do and it's relevant to this. So as I mentioned, our organization is focused on building a more equitable economy because we know that the economy is not working for everyone, right? And I think it shows up in elections, and it shows up on how we're not getting along with our neighbors and loved ones. And so we have three different pillars. One that focuses on entrepreneurship and providing resources and access to capital and education resources to entrepreneurs of color, women entrepreneurs. We have another pillar. The focus is.
My notifications keep going. I'm sorry.
Okay. Then we have another pillar that focuses on connecting women professionals from C-suite to emerging leaders, where we provide executive coaching and peer networking throughout the year consistently. And we've been doing that since 2020 because of the disproportionate effect the pandemic had on women at work. And then our third pillar is investing in women-led companies that are building solutions in the care economy, right? And we heard that a lot during this election for those as they were paying attention. Kamala Harris did actually talk a lot about the economy and the sandwich generation and how working families are really hurting because we don't have a care infrastructure that supports working families when it comes to caring for our children, caring for our parents, grandparents, and loved ones. So that's what I do on a day-to-day basis.
Okay. Tell me about some of the encounters you have in carrying out that work, right? Because I mean, if we look at how Oklahoma votes as an indication of maybe what you're up against in the work that you do, how does that play out for you? What do you encounter? Some of the challenges and obstacles that you may have?
Ooh, I mean, yeah. I don't think we have enough time, but very proud to be here. I continue to stay in the state because of the people. And once you get to know the people, you realize what a wonderful place it is, right? Once you're able to get to know one another. But honestly, to do the work that I do, it's been extremely challenging, right? And we launched our organization back in 2017 when there wasn't a lot of other people doing what we do, right? And we launched with pillar one, which is focus on entrepreneurship. And we were very intentional about supporting women and people of color. And so, you know, so at the time it wasn't, you know, very popular. Nobody wanted to support the work that we do. And then the Thunder started partnering with us, and then we started getting other traction. And then, you know, the people that we were helping started succeeding, and there were success stories and stuff like that. So that started giving us a little bit more visibility and support within the state, but it wasn't easy at the beginning, and it's still not easy, right? Then you had 2020, where other people all of a sudden realized that we have a race problem in America, and you did have a lot of corporations and a lot of like focus on supporting women, people of color. I think to an extent, it actually hurt us that it was like such a vivid push, because I think a lot of it was performative.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And then what ended up happening is there were some Oklahoma organizations that started paying attention and started informing and stuff like that. But then when there's no, you know, support throughout time, it's hard to sustain. And so we've been around before it was sexy to do the work that we do, while it was sexy, and then now in the anti-DEI mm-hmm. era, right? And we're doing it right here from the state of Oklahoma, where, you know, we rank worst state in the nation for women.
Right.
You know, our governor has already stated that he doesn't want any state dollars going towards initiatives that focus on DEI efforts. So it hasn't been easy. I guess a long way to answer your question, it hasn't been easy. We have actually found support from outside the state. A lot of the programs that we do are national in nature. But we continue to do work here in the state and are very proud of that. But we've had to be very creative because it's not, you know, it's not like funders are crazy about funding the work that we do.
So can you drill down just a little bit? I think you said you met a lot of resistance. And I'm just curious how that manifests itself. Was it just sort of, your phone calls didn't get returned? It was, you got, well, this is lovely, you're doing this, but you got patted on the head and sent on down the road. I mean, I'm just curious,
yeah.
You know, what yeah. the resistance is actually like, and why, and what you think that says about us as Oklahomans.
Yeah. I think twofold, right? So back in 2017, keep in mind, I'm also a recovering economic developer. So I work for the Oklahoma Department of Commerce and actually led the international division, which did focus on recruiting large corporations to the state and, you know, creating jobs and all of that traditional economic development through acquisition, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
And when I left, you know, I worked for this private investment organization that focused exclusively on aerospace and defense. And when I was trying to convince, I actually didn't want to start an organization myself. I wanted somebody else to do the work. So I, you know, knocked the doors on, I mean, from economic development organizations to private organizations to say, hey, I feel like we're losing a lot of young talent because they feel like they can't stay here and build sustainable, high potential growth companies because we don't have the infrastructure or the support mechanisms to help them. And we should address that. And the first type of resistance I felt was more geared towards economic development, right? So like I had a lot of people say to me, well, that's cute what you're doing, but that's not real economic development. Mm. Real economic development is, you know, acquiring this, like supporting big job creation, right? Because the way we measure economic development today is based on job creation, which is very important, but it's also put entrepreneurship as like second, like, oh, that's cute, you know, like second tier type of economic development.
We do pay a lot of lip service to that though in this state.
Especially now.
Yeah.
But back then, it wasn't, right? And I also think that back then the mentality was, well, we already have an SBA. You know, there's a difference between supporting high growth potential companies versus mainstream type of businesses, right? And again, and then there was no real effort to support or to acknowledge that women and people of color have even more barriers to entry when it comes to entrepreneurship. Anyways, but so the first resistance was that it was, you know, like, oh, entrepreneurship is cute, but it's never going, you know, like we already do that. We have some agencies doing that, so we don't need to do that. So that was resistant number one. Resistant number two was, you know, when we started being more vocal about the additional barriers to entry that women, people of color experience when not just starting businesses, but when growing businesses, which, you know, a lot of that has to do with access to capital, but also access to resources, access to networks, and so on. That was resistant number two. Resistant number three is women. You know, when we launched Vest and our two pillars focus on women, it became very clear to me that both men and women continue to undervalue women's potential, and we lack empathy for women across the board. And I'm not just talking to my male peers, I'm talking about women as well. And so there's been several layers of resistance that we've encountered, you know, that we continue to figure out, okay, how do we continue to do the work? Because we know it's meaningful and we know we need to be here, but I'm not going to lie to you. It hasn't been easy doing it here from Oklahoma. I even have funders outside of the state that say, why do you continue to do this there? Right? Like maybe it'd be easier for you to raise more funding if you move to other places.
I actually had the exact same thing asked of me by my, so during my doctoral program, we always had to present our our proposals to PhD seminars. So all the faculty in the department, all the grad students. And I was, you know, coming back to do a topic here in Oklahoma. And I literally had like the top faculty member in the department ask me, why are you going back?
Yeah. Yeah, it's sad. I mean, and you know, I think that this election emphasize it even more. I think that I've been sounding the bell to my friends and colleagues and peers that live in blue states or in the coastal areas. You know, when Roe was overturned, I, you know, went to just about every event that would have me to talk about, you know, the economic, I mean, obviously the most important thing when we talk about abortion is protecting the life of both the children and the mother, you know, and the women. But then there's also the economic side of abortion and how it disproportionately affects women, right? And I would go to these conferences, and most of the time when I would say I'm from Oklahoma, I was kind of like a little bit of condescending, you know, or like,
yes,
are you from there? But I, you know, I would tell them, if you're not paying attention to what's happening in Oklahoma and you think that it's not going to affect you because you live in a blue state, then you're really not paying attention. And I think my friends are now finally, like, I, you know, they listen to me, but now that they're seeing the Ryan Walters of the world, or they're seeing a lot of the things that were already implemented here, I think it's really hitting a different tune with them.
No, I've had the same experience with people on the East Coast, specifically on the coast, who just kind of, you know, you never feel more like flyover country when you're flyover country, you know, just like, the way they ignore what's happening here, and it's really off-putting in many ways. Just like, you know, what makes you think like, you know, this can't happen to you, you know? But at the same time, just like, and actually the ignorance, I would say, these are my strong words, but the ignorance of actually what it means, you know, to be here with this happening. But I want to talk about what you're saying with like the economic impact, because, you know, you think of, okay, so the immediate, you know, so I'm no economist, I'm no healthcare economist, but so if you think about abortion as an issue, of course it has direct immediate impact on the person who needs that procedure, their health, their immediate family. But then you think of, okay, what is the impact on the healthcare providers? Whether or not they want to stay where they are practicing, if these are the, you know, constraints within which they are expected to practice. You know, so then that has an effect then on the healthcare systems if these providers are choosing not to be here. And then that has, you know, an effect, you know, the multiplying effect then on all the other workers that no longer have jobs because these providers have chosen to leave. You know, and then just the overall well-being of the state. And, you know, what's frustrating is this state knows this information.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, we have been dealing with the impacts of a underfunded, under-resourced healthcare system in the state of Oklahoma since the state refused to pass the ACA after the Supreme Court, you know, rolled it back. And I mean, so this is not a new discussion. you know, but abortion is just one issue, you know, of many, not to minimize its impact, but all these really harmful impacts, all this really harmful policy positions on women, like you say, you know, have a disproportionate impact on women specifically, but then that splinters, you know, and like crystallizes across the community. And I'm just thinking about your third point of resistance, you know, with women, like women as a point of resistance on something that's supposed to, you know, benefit women. It's really interesting because I think this is a really good like segue into what we were, you know, here to talk about today. So the Oklahoma Commission on the Status of Women had an event where they brought in two legislators to talk about like a legislative update. And one of the state senators, like, the reason I knew about it is because one of our state senators posted, well, I guess I won't be going to that, because it was Daryl Weaver and Shane Jett coming to give a legislative update, you know, for the Commission on the Status of Women. Which is like, talk about a rock in the pit of your stomach. When you think that these two, you know, these two men were brought in to tell women what the legislature has done for them.
So what you're saying is that if you looked up mansplaining in the dictionary, you would see the flyer for that event.
I mean, it's pretty awful. Do you have any insight into that event or anything? Can you tell us anything about that?
Yeah, so I saw it probably by following the same representative online. And look, all I will say is, and I'm not here to bash anyone, particularly women, but I am here to keep us accountable, right? Uh-huh. And I think you talk about mansplaining and the men that are speaking. The saddest thing to me is that this is the Commission of Women. Like, this is women putting this event together, and you either lack the self-awareness or the, you know, or you don't care, right?
Right.
Because we do rank as the worst state in the nation for women. A lot of the policies that have compounded this inequity towards women have been put into place by the same males you're inviting to speak. And like, so to me, what affected me the most when I saw that was not just the timing, was not just the speakers, it was just the fact that once again it's women enabling these people to continue to do harm and to continue to pass policies and to continue to provide misinformation, which then affects voters who think that they're doing the right thing, you know, and then here we are again. And all of these cycles compound, and that's how we've got to where we are in the state of Oklahoma. And so what do I think about that event? You know, I've been invited actually several times to speak to that group, and I've said no because, and not just to point out that specific group, but there have been, one of the things that we need to recognize as women is that sometimes we've been our own worst enemy and our own worst advocate, right? And I refuse to do any performative work, right? So I remember one time, and it wasn't this group, it was another group, it was another senator that wanted to do a study on, because she couldn't believe that Oklahoma was ranked, you know, last in the nation when it comes to women. And so she did a special study, and she invited me to speak. And she says, you know, you and I don't agree all the time, but I respect you and I respect the work that you do. So I would love for you to come and speak to this interim study that I'm doing on whether or not this is factual. And I'm like, okay, you know, and of course she followed me. And at the time it was X, so I was even more vocal. And so anyway, so I end up getting there. And the first thing she says to me as she opens the session is, or not just to me, but to everyone there, is, okay, we're here to talk about this, but we can't talk about abortion. And I think I was like the first or second speaker lineup. You know, so I got up and I said, listen, first of all, don't invite me to speak and ask me not to share what I really think, right? And we can't have an honest conversation about women's, the status of women, if we don't talk about the issues mainly affecting us. You talked a lot when you were addressing the economics, you actually were talking about indirect cost of abortion, right? Like what's going to happen to our healthcare providers, the cost of caring, all of those things. The first and most impact is the single factor that affects a women's ability to have economic mobility. It's our ability to plan if and when we have family.
Mm-hmm.
And so number one, right there, you're taking that away from us. And that is economic empowerment, right? So I refuse to go into spaces where you're going to say, let's talk about women. What do you want me to say? Like girl boss, like I don't do any of that
stuff. Yeah, yeah, yeah. That's yeah, raw, raw, look at us, all a bunch of badass women, right, but right.
I also don't do events where, you know, you're going to talk about women's issue and you're going to have the, you know, two male legislators talk about, and also it said, like, we're going to talk about our wins. Which wins?
I know, right?
What wins can you possibly talk about?
Right. Right.
So anyway, I mean, I just, I was really disappointed and I continue to be disappointed, not just in the state of our, you know, legislative, whatever you want to call it, but also just on how we as women continue to give them a platform to do what they're doing.
It reminds me a lot of the kind of conversation that bubbled up around the election about people being surprised that women were having to hide who they were voting for from their husbands, mm-hmm. you know, and it's like, yeah, that is what world do these people live in where they don't understand that this is truly the dynamic that some women are living under. But then the women that continue to consent to this, I mean, I think this is, to me, this is kind of the heart of the thing, is that these are women literally consenting to their own marginalization. And it's not consciously, right? They're not saying I'm leaving the house today to be an oppressed woman, but they are saying patriarchy is what I choose, you know, in their actions, in their implicit and, you know, their explicit work that they do, the way that they live their lives, the way that they do not question power, you know, that is literally like the work of hegemony, right? The work of power is to keep people complying and agreeing to their own oppression. And like those, I know those are like really strong words, and I don't think I've ever actually used those on this podcast, Arnold, but I mean, it's certainly, it's certainly what we talk about, but it's just never been so explicit when you see this group of women, and it's a lot of women, like there's a lot of like really prominent ladies sitting on this commission, right? I mean, super, super prominent. And to see what they're, you know, agreeing to is really pretty. I think it just tells us a lot about our state,
yeah.
You know? And so, I mean, it's just, that commission is, kind of a snapshot, right? A microcosm of these very well-to-do, because they're all well-to-do in their own ways. They may not make a lot of money, but they're well-positioned, and to agree and consent to a panel like that, you know, that is very much the definition of hegemony, right? Agreeing to the terms of your own oppression.
Yeah. You know, I'm going to give some the benefit of the doubt, because I I don't know how well organized.
Sure. Yeah, the people just didn't say all agree to, yes, let's have these people. Yeah.
I don't know how long it's been around. I don't know who's actually engaged, who's not, who actually attends them and who doesn't. But I think that to your point, I think we have to recognize that there's definitely the women that, vote, like you're saying, against their own rights. There's those that are misinformed. There are those that are so busy. You know, I can speak in the Latino community.
Right.
That's for another podcast, but
right.
we're working, from 6 a.m. to
whatever knows at night. Yeah.
And then we come home and we, do the unpaid labor at home. We're tired. We're not paying attention. Right. Huh? There are those voters. And then, you absolutely are right in that there's also that group of voters that has achieved influence or positions of power because of their proximity to man. And they're going to hold on to that power, even at the expense of putting our own in jeopardy, right? And that those are the ones that I do want to hold accountable, because we should know better, right? Like, we have enough access, we have enough resources. It's not like we don't,
Right.
We should know better.
And I think that's the story of a lot of what we see of the worst of Oklahoma politics right now, not just from women, but from men, right? People who want to be approximate to power, who want to contain their, who want to continue their positions of influence. Ryan Walters is the best example, right? People, everyone's got stories of when he used to be kind of a cool history teacher back in the day, and now he's this guy. And, that I think that's very much, that's Shane Jett, right? I mean, like, what in the world? I mean, I can't explain it. I'm not in their head. I don't know any of these people individually, right? I've just yelled at Ryan Walters in a public setting before. I haven't really, that's the most that I can claim. But I mean, it is just eternally perplexing that we have a state that has so much potential and so much promise. And yet there's a group like this of 98% white ladies, who put on a panel like this. And so the cynic in me really questions, how much of that is the real power players on that commission, whoever's really in charge. And I think you know what I mean by that. Are they just capitalizing on the inattention, of some of the members? Because I think, and you brought something else up too that I think is so important. It's that, what is it? Arundhati Roy, who said, it's not, there's not the voiceless, there's just the intentionally unheard, and so we have women, we have people, but we have a whole group of, community of people who are so subsumed by the economic realities of their day-to-day lives, just trying to keep the lights on and food on the table and care for their families and the people around them, that it's just not, the capability to fully engage and be always online like some of us, paying attention to all these things, is just not there, but I think that's a part of this story that absolutely we cannot, we need to highlight. But this group in particular is just really, really troubling. because it just tells us so much about what's wrong, what's going on with this state, in that, these women could be the thought leaders and the opinion leaders, and they could really push the agenda, and maybe they could check some of this.
Yeah.
They really could check some of it.
Yeah.
My hunch though is that, this is, in many ways, this is not unique to Oklahoma. I think because we're here and because we know it's worse here probably than in a lot of other states. Mm-hmm. It's particularly vexing for us. But I just keep sitting here thinking, we're in the 21st century, for God's sake. And, we act like we're still back in the 1950s or whatever in so many ways here.
Well, like the year 1100 is what I'd say.
Well, okay. All right. I was trying to be nice about it. But I guess, Erica, I'm trying to figure out how this moves forward, particularly because the thing that makes it I don't care what community you're in Oklahoma, whether it's, you're middle class white or upper middle class white, or you're Latino, or you're black, or it doesn't, Native American, but whatever it is, religion plays such a huge role in this state in terms of sort of the patriarchy and the male dominance and that sort of thing. And it's really, how you break through all that to get people, enough people headed in the right direction. And maybe it just evolves over time, and it's not a straight, upward, trajectory. It's up and down and all that. But it's terribly frustrating to me that we haven't made more progress than we have. And I have to lay a lot of it at the feet of organized religion. And as somebody who's a churchgoer, so I mean, but not a church that does what the empire wants.
Well, I mean, I couldn't agree with you more. I think that, and I think you're absolutely right, Arnold. I think that this is not unique to Oklahoma. I mean, we support and have invested in women-led companies across the United States. And what we see is because of societal norms, because of indoctrination, women have developed what I call like toxic habits, right? That like just keep us in this never-ending cycle. And those are, number one is this perfectionism, right? Because the workplace was never designed with us in mind, we have been. And because both men and women continue to undervalue the potential of women, we strive for perfectionism, right? And so to the point that we become hypervigilant and uber critical of ourselves, right? So how does that translate into the political arena? Well, we don't want to talk, even if we, even if our husbands are voting the same way, we don't want to talk about politics. We don't want to, because we're so focused on being almost perfect, to because we feel like we have to do that in order to have a seat at the table. And for women of color, it's like three times that, because we've been told and therefore internalize that we need to be two or three times as better just to have a seat. So this, so this hypervigilance and this strive for a perfection, I think, has led to a lot of this. The second toxic behavior that I think we've taken on is assimilation, right? So in order to survive, whether it's at work or in societies or in the state of Oklahoma, we just become one of the boys or one of the guys or one of whatever, right? Because it's, we're tired and we're trying to be perfect and we're trying to be hyper. So it's easier if we just assimilate and we become one of, to the point that we give our core identity away, right? Just to feel, just to survive. So that's, so assimilation is number two. This has then lead to, this myth of meritocracy of,
Yes. Oh my God, yes, myth.
right, which then has led us women to compete with one another and to feel like in order to succeed, we have to just put our head down and work really, really hard and then do all of the things and then we'll get to the top. And I can't speak to everyone, but I know I can speak for myself and for a lot of other women who I have shared this conversation with that have gotten to the top. We get there only to feel extremely lonely because it doesn't matter if we have amazing male peers and amazing male mentors and amazing male sponsors, the lived experiences are always going to be so different, right? Just by nature and just by societal norms, that if we don't figure out how to not compete with one another, but instead support one another as we achieve those positions, then we're never going to really ultimately change environments and change toxic workplaces and do all of that. So I think that's another thing. And anyways, I could keep talking about that, but I think all of this has led into what we're seeing today. Women not even at our own expense, not challenging the status quo, figuring out how to navigate and assimilate to the status quo today. Easier to compete with women and, you know, attack women. You're liberal, you're too progressive, or you know, whatever, trad wife, childless cat lady, whatever labels you want to put. That has somehow become easier than really addressing the fundamentals that we have been led to believe that we can thrive here. But the reality is women have been the safety net for our economy in America. And we just continue to operate that way because there's not enough paying attention. There's not enough of us doing the work together and challenging it.
I mean, I'm thank you so much for bringing it back together like that, right? Like, I mean, just kind of bringing it back to really the heart of this is that, you know, and you're not just saying these things. Like, there's decades and decades of research saying exactly what you just said, is that, you know, women are literally the safety net. They always have been. This is not a 20th or 21st, 20th century thing. This has been through the Industrial Revolution. This has been pre-Industrial Revolution. The care that women give, you know, at all levels, is literally what keeps society moving forward. And yet we're insisting on women operating at a deficit, right? A continual deficit, you know, in bandwidth, in emotional capacity, in resources. You know, and I just thought of something. What's interesting to me too is the way that, okay, so you talk about women getting to the top and being lonely. You know, how much this dynamic, this cultural dynamic, relies on women being broken apart from each other, right? Like, how much of it, the oxygen that kind of fuels it is the fact that we cannot band together, right? Well, so the lack of solidarity.
The lack of solidarity and the other toxic behavior that I mentioned before, the other one is the self-sacrifice.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we've enamored with the self-sacrificing, and in a way it's very noble and, you know, of course, it's a gift. But at what point does it become toxic, right? Mm-hmm. When we are self-sacrificing at home, doing all of the unpaid labor, and then we come to work and do the sacrificing there by taking on, like, oh, you know, we need to do a team building activity. Who's going to do it? Well, usually it's women taking on the, or, you know, somebody's birthday, who's going to go get the cake and do that's, mm-hmm. you know, that's unpaid labor. And then when you talk about volunteering, you know, and doing some work at the, you know, who sits on boards, who wants, like, nonprofits and all of that, it's women. Right. And so I think all of these things compound, and yeah, it causes us to not work together, in fact it causes us to compete with one another, right? Mm-hmm. Because there's so few of us at the top that we feel like we have to compete for those few spots as opposed to working together. So I think everything contributes to that, and I think it's just to Arnold's original point, I think it's been instilled in our brain, and we need to unlearn a lot of things before we can allow new information to dive in.
You know, I just want to add, like, you know, my past couple of years and my most recent work experience, I've been a part of and experienced groups of women trying to challenge like just entrenched inequity, exploitation, and victimization in the workplace. And so when these groups of women have come together, in one instance, they've been told to stop gossiping. Mm-hmm. Because that's all we can be doing if we're talking as women, right, is gossiping. We can't actually be like... Right. Yes, we can't actually be sharing our real experiences of being victimized, and I will say by other women, first of all. Mm-hmm. But then the structures that exist in the workplace through the IEO, through, you know, federal law that has been changed by the last Trump administration, things were dismissed because there just weren't policies and, you know, like actual federal policies in place that would validate what had happened to these women, right? So, you know, I've been a part of that. I have experienced some very close friends in another group that have done that, and it has been completely invalidated, both like by the structures of the institution where we worked, but also by our direct leadership and supervisors, right? That what we were doing was divisive, like you said, that we were just gossiping, and then they did everything they could to split everybody apart. So. You didn't have that form of that sense of community and solidarity to support each other. So all the ways that this exists, you know, culturally and in society, but then you think of these women that are together on purpose and all they're doing is supporting and buffeting, mm-hmm. right? The very structures that kind of keep us apart. And so when I was like thinking about the intro that I will eventually record for this, I thought of Audre Lorde was the first person that I could think of. And, you know, the master's tools will not dismantle the master's house. But that's where we're at, mm-hmm. right? You see these groups of women specifically, and I'm sorry, I'm going to call you all out, ladies, but thinking that the master's tools are going to help them somehow.
They haven't, right?
And they won't.
If what they want, we would be in a different, completely different.
Exactly. Right. Like we would not be criticized because we need help with childcare, right? Like we would not have to worry about childcare probably. Right. Like these work structures would not be in place if, oh my God. And I'll just say like, to that end, you know, my daughter was texting me from school because some things were happening. And so I apologize for that, you know, intrusion early, but that's literally what was happening, right? That's our lives, right, Erica? Like we're having to like help our kids constantly all day through the day. Arnold, do you have anything else?
No, I guess, Erica, I'm curious if there's no magic bullet, I would assume, to sort of move the needle forward on this, but, you know, I keep thinking, well, you know, if we elected more women, if the legislature, for example, were more representative in terms of gender of the state as a whole, and then I think, no, some of the female legislators I've met, I don't want them really in positions of a power.
Because there's four on that commission. There are four members on that commission.
And it just, I'm trying to figure out how we all work together to help sort of move this. And I know the work you're doing is excellent. But for those of us who are maybe lay people listening to this, you know, how do you begin to get minds to change? Cause I remember when Obama got elected president, I thought we have turned a corner in this country. And what I didn't realize is that we had lifted the rock.
We turned a corner, all right.
A lot of this was going to slither back out from under, and it was going to be worse. And we still, I keep thinking, if we could just elect a woman as president, people will see that this is, you know, one, and we can't get over the hump on that, you know. And it's like, my God, you know, how do we, God, am I going to live long enough to see it here in Oklahoma? I don't know.
I don't have the magic bullet either, but I think the reason why I said yes to this conversation is because I do think that we need to have more conversations. You know, I think I'm not going to be one of those like, you know, pundits that this is what went wrong with the election, because I think anybody that does that, I don't pay attention to, because like they're making fast decisions, mm-hmm. you know, that election, like we're still assessing, right? But what I would tell you, and because I work in tech, I will tell you that, you know, for me, what was very interesting, and I have a lot, so I work in tech, and then I also have a lot of creators that I'm friends with, and, you know, they went to the DNC and they create a massive amount of content. But I also know how tech work, and I know that it doesn't matter how much content I produce, it was only going to show up in people that already think like me, right? And maybe mm-hmm. few others. And so I think that we need to have more conversations. I wasn't there last week, by the way, so I'm not telling you something that I need to work on this too. But we need to have conversations with people that at different stages that we are, right? Like, and come at it from a non-judgmental way, to talk about, because I think that ultimately what's happening is, there is a class difference right now, and there are a lot of working families that are hurting, and they don't know where to direct that anger and that resentment. And what's happening is then we're turning into our social outlets with, for a lot of us, it's social media. And, but if all we're seeing, I mean, I worry about young men, you know, young men, I don't know if you've seen some of the podcasts and some of the influencers that they listen to, you know, I no wonder they're resenting women. No wonder they feel the way that they do. And if they're consuming this consistently, it's very easy to become radicalized. You know, and so I think that it's not a magic bullet, but we have to have more conversations, and we have to figure out how to talk about lifting the working class in ways that actually matter, not just by blaming immigrants or one group of people. You know, that's not going to help us get, we really need to explain policies, and we need to explain, and we need to reach people where they are, even if it takes us to places where I don't necessarily like to be, but otherwise we're going to lose, we're going to continue to lose young males. And we're going to continue to lose women that just think they just need to assimilate and do what they have to do to continue to move up the ladder.
That's long. That's a long, hard work. I'd love to make a magic wand, but I think you're right. These things don't happen overnight. Our system is not designed, you know, and human nature is not designed for it to flip a switch.
Right. And, you know, I would love to tell you that it's, I mean, of course, I believe it's systemic change, right? It's policy. But as proven by this election, we can't get there unless we start here. And yes, and you know, that's another thing, like, I tell people, you know, I posted yesterday, I'm finally back online, and I'm happy to answer a question. And I kid you not, I probably got 10 questions all asking me the same question. How do we get rid of Ryan Walters? Right.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that we need to do, and I need to be mindful of, is that we can't wait until the next election. We can't wait until the next ballot. We have to be doing the work in communicating this and organizing and doing listening sessions throughout the year consistently. And we need to build the infrastructure for the organizations like yours, like, you know, others, Oklahoma Policy Institute, Together Oklahoma, whoever's doing the work of getting communities together to talk about issues. We need to be supporting them, and funders need to be supporting them and funding them. Otherwise, it's not going to change, right? Otherwise, we're going to have these conversations, you know, 2 months before the election or 3 months before the election. And by that time, I feel like it's too late and it's not consistent, and it's not sustainable.
Well, you know, I just want to really quick jump in, because it just makes me think of, you know, we want to dissect this election as a country and not state by state. And I really think, like, I'm a big proponent of everything is hyper local, right? Like, we really have to think hyper locally, specifically in a state like Oklahoma. I've said it many times, like, people may vote one way when they're thinking statewide, but when they're thinking very locally, it's a very different picture. We've seen that in the ballot box time and time again in the state of Oklahoma, right? So how do you tell people in Atoka, you know, how these issues impact them, and how, you know, these are the ways to help in these specific areas, addressing exactly what you're saying, like the economic issues, the class-based issues, right? In ways that apply to Atoka, not the ways that apply to the U.S.
Yeah. And if you look at states that have done it well, they have local community organizing organizations that are well-funded, multi-year funding. Mm-hmm. They don't have to worry whether they're going to exist next year because the election went one way or another. They have the support of funders, and they know that it's a long-term investment. Right. And they're going to be doing the work year round and going to those places. They know these people trust, people trust them because they're consistent and they are there. And I think we have amazing organizations in the state of Oklahoma trying to do the work. I think they're underfunded and underworked.
Overworked and under-resourced, right? Like,
I'm just curious, and I know we need to wrap up here, but if you share my optimism, though, that if you look at this election as just sort of a snapshot of where we are headed potentially, if you look at the two urban centers, if you look at the two urban largest urban counties, the vote totals were very close. Kamala Harris came within about 4,000 votes in Oklahoma County out of almost 300,000 votes, I think, cast. It was about 30,000 in Tulsa County. And this doesn't include the suburbs. Okay. This is just Oklahoma County and Tulsa County. They're the two highest growth county. I mean, the urban centers are the growth centers in Oklahoma. And so it seems to me that we're sort of getting there. Tulsa elects a Black mayor for the first time, a Democrat.
Amazing Black mayor, yep.
Amazing.
Mm-hmm.
Republican Tulsa, all my life, Tulsa, Republican, boom. Oklahoma City has a mayor who, while he and I have disagreed on many things over the course of the years, has been a uniter and not a divider, I think, in many ways. And he's stood up for the marginalized. He's welcomed, publicly at least, everybody to the table. And I can't help but think that's the Oklahoma that we're striving to get toward, and the Oklahoma that we're seeing glimmers of hope that it really is going to take place. And as it does, I have to think the rural areas, which, are shrinking, but still, I would think they come along because they see what happens when you're building. Oklahoma City and Tulsa are becoming, top-notch cities in many ways. And that's the way you build, in my view, that's the way you build a top-notch 21st century city, is by welcoming everybody to the table and unleashing them to be all that they can be, right?
I'm really curious about that, because I think that's like, yes, I want to say yes, but then I think, maybe Nicole McAfee might have a different perspective.
She may be right and I'm not.
I don't know, like just in rural Oklahoma, because I feel like at the end of the day, I feel like any community in this state is going to love its own people. I really feel like that. I really feel like they're going to watch out for themselves. And I don't mean that in like the selfish sense, like they're going to watch out for their community and that's what they do. But then I'm just like, I feel like, the kids growing up in this state that in immigrants specifically now, right? Like our immigrant workers, our migrant workers throughout the state would have a very different story. And so it's like, I just wonder, because I agree with you, Arnold, but then I just think like, we being mindful of, our trans LGBTQ plus community throughout the state, our, people of color throughout the state, that's a very different experience for them.
No question.
I'm just like wondering like how that actually looks, because I want to agree with you and I believe in the hyperlocal piece. But at the same time, like there are still going to be people who are othered everywhere in this state, right? That's why we are where we are.
And remember, I said, while it was close in Oklahoma County, it's right. Carried both counties. I mean, and some really good Democratic candidates didn't win legislative seats that should have, or it would have been a great thing if they had, for the state.
Yeah, I mean, you think about Erin Brewer, though. She was really close.
Yeah.
But, I mean, that's not a surprise, I don't think. I think everyone would say she'd need another cycle to be elected, But I don't know. This is like, now we're in, like, insider baseball talk, right? So
I was trying to find some hope.
I'm sorry, Erica. I didn't mean to, like,
totally, at the end of the conversation.
But this is where we
would say, yes, it's worth, we're seeing the dividends are beginning to be paid on some of this, as people rise up and say, hey, we're not going to stand for this anymore. This is not, this is not who we should aspire to be.
But this, well, Erica, I'm sorry, this is a, I have a question for you based on that. Because our is industry, I feel like those, that purple, those purple gains are because of industry, of, you know, economic growth, new companies coming into town. And is that going to continue and keep purpling Oklahoma with the current state of things? Does that make, do I make sense?
Yeah. So I agree with both of you. And I think, I think it goes back to how important us talking to one another is, right? Regardless of where we are. Funny enough, I have people that voted for Trump that are now texting me about, you know, how do they help their immigrant, you know, somebody that they know that's here undocumented or wait or pending status, but they don't want them to get deported, right? And that's, we've separated ourselves and we dehumanize groups of people and we've normalized the Trump narrative. And that's what's dangerous. And that's why we need to get back to like the socialization and the one-on-one conversations, which is going to take a long time. Here's what I will say in terms of economics. I do think that here's the real honest truth. The middle of the country doesn't have enough people to keep up with the growth that we're seeing economically. So we're either going to have to import or grow, you know, and that's why I say when people say to me, well, why are you investing and focusing on like, you know, Latinos and, you know, Native Americans? And I'm like, because if you put us together, we're actually going to be the new majority, you know, very soon.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
And so when you talk about labor force and who's going to be doing the work, we need more people. And if we're going to continue to exclude people, whether they're trans women or LGBTQ plus, anybody that doesn't feel safe and welcome in our state, then we're never going to achieve that growth that Mayor Holt and now Mayor Monroe, you know, are seeking to get to. Because in order to do that, we need people, we need diversity, we are better for that. As a business person, I always tell people, listen, call it what you will. Don't call it DEI, call it whatever makes you feel comfortable. But here's the truth, demographics are changing. And so when you say that you don't want to invest in these things, basically what you're saying is you don't want to invest in this new potential group of consumers, this new potential group of workers that can work for you, that can help you get a better perspective on the market and all of this. So I do think that industry and business are going to lead us to towards that because it makes economic sense. I hope, part of my hope is that we also get to figure out people that have felt left out of this innovation economy and this economy in general in rural America, because I think that that's part of what has led us to this. These people feel disenfranchised, these people feel left out, and they're turning to anger, they're turning to resentment, they're turning to a lot of isms, you know, I mean,
mm-hmm.
they're taking it out on people. I just wonder if it's, well, I know if they're not taking it out on the right people, right? And it's really a matter of economics and the wealth gaps that exist now. And they're not talking about that because one party's telling them that they should just be blaming a certain group as opposed to really offering true solutions for them. So I really do hurt for those communities that are going to be left out, particularly if we continue to vote for people that say they care about them, but they really don't.
This was a phenomenal conversation. Thank you so much for joining us. No, seriously, like so thought provoking and, you know, not just the surface level. These women are terrible. Just like, there's just so much going on because they're not terrible.
Some are.
They can
we're
do
not better. We're
off. We're still recording. But like, they can do better at least, right? Like they can do better.
I mean, and you can put this on, you know, I tell friends, I'm willing to do the sermon on what happened in this election. And I'm willing to hold my Latino community accountable where we need to be held accountable. And I want to do all of the deep dive into everything. But we also have to acknowledge the fundamentals. Mm-hmm. You know, racism play a role in this.
Mm-hmm. White ladies, we got to do better. White ladies, we suck. We suck.
You know, misogyny played a role in this. Mm-hmm. And unless...
internalized misogyny. Mm-hmm.
Right. And unless we're willing to accept the fundamentals, everything else to me is semantics, right? Like there are some things that played a fundamental role in this and that blindsided us, right? Like, I don't, you know, like people that say, well, she didn't talk enough about the economy. What? That's all she talked about. Oh, she, you know, the party, I had somebody say, no, you know, they made it all about identity politics. And I'm like, listen, there was only one party that spent millions and millions of dollars targeting 1% of the population. And that was the Republican Party. Kamala actually pissed off a lot of people by not making it about certain groups of people, but about everyone.
But that's the thing, though, right? Like, that is literally the thing. That is literally the thing.
It's also, you know, it's also, there were some people that are just not okay with a women president. There were some people that are not, definitely not okay with a Black women president. And there were people that just, you know, wanted her to be perfect in every other way while letting Trump do very vulgar stuff. And anybody that doesn't want to accept that, I don't care to have a real discussion with, because you're not willing to look at the fundamentals before we get then into tactics, right?
Mm-hmm. So. It's been a pleasure today. Thank you so much for your time.
Sorry, I
rambled. Pleasure in like all the worst ways, right? Like you wish we could talk about like, you know, feel good stuff, but we love getting into the weeds and you know, even going down the insider baseball talk.
And I appreciate what you guys do. Something we didn't talk about because it wasn't pertinent to this, but as we move forward, I think the local outlets like this are going to play a major role moving forward. The question is, how do we fund them, right? Because we see that the distrust in big conglomerates and big media outlets you know, and a lot of the shift, especially with younger demographics shifting into podcasts, into video content and all of that. The problem is, who do you trust and who's doing the actual work? And then how do you fund them so that they can continue to do more of it and reach larger audience? So thank you guys for doing the work that you do.
Thank you so much. And let's have this let's keep talking about this. Let's keep having the conversation.
Thank you for listening to this episode of ObserverCast. If you like what you hear, please tell your friends about us and share our episodes far and wide on social media. If you're interested in sponsoring ObserverCast, please give Arnold Hamilton a call at 405-478-8700 or drop him an email at ahamilton@okobserver.org. You can also support ObserverCast with a tax-deductible donation to the Oklahoma Observer Democracy Foundation, whose mission is to help create a better, more informed Oklahoma. And to help keep us on the air, visit okobserver.org and click on the Donate button on the upper right side of the homepage. We also urge you to subscribe to the Oklahoma Observer, now in its 55th year of comforting the afflicted and afflicting the comfortable. We have a special digital subscription rate for ObserverCast listeners, only $1.99 a month for the first year. That's 50% off the usual rate for monthly digital subscribers. Just use the coupon code ObserverCast when checking out to get the discount rate. And finally, we want to thank Jared Deck for the music you're listening to in the background here. He's not just a resident of Norman anymore. He is now the Oklahoma State Representative for House District 44. Congratulations, Representative Deck. We're so proud of you. But you can still download his albums at iTunes and learn more, including dates for any upcoming performances at jareddeckmusic.com.